Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Rob Dunn, a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. And we're talking about his book, Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets, and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. Rob, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's great to be on this show. Thanks so much for having me.
There are certain books that I consider to be classics of science for public use that really explain how science is done, and this is one of them. This is a book about the wildlife in our homes. How did you start down this route? Because you write in the book, you were one of these, I don't want to say traditional ecologists, but one of these ecologists, as the public expects, is studying, you know, stuff in the jungles, in the rainforests. How did you get switched to looking at life in the house?
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, I grew up in cold Michigan and found that the tropics was warm and fascinating and so embarked on a path that would have me for most of my career finding new species and making new discoveries in remote rainforests. And then I got a job and I started training students. And when I started training those students, it became more and more clear that many of the kinds of discoveries I would make in Bolivia or Australia or West Africa, that we could make the same sorts of discoveries in the city. And then we started to make discoveries in backyards. And eventually we started to make discoveries sort of on back porches, and they kept creeping in. And at some point it became more and more clear that there was a whole bunch of stuff we didn't know about our own houses. And then stuff started to get really fun because we could we didn't have to leave home. We could just peek under the bed and see new stuff.
And it is, I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, this is a really revealing book. You'll never look at your shower head the same way after reading this book, and we'll talk about that in just a second. One of the central figures, almost heroes of this book, is Antony van Leeuwenhoek. Can you talk about who he is for the benefit of the audience?
Yeah, so he was an amateur scientist, well, it doesn't do him full justice, in the town of Delft in the Netherlands in the late 1600s. And, you know, it was a town filled mostly with artists. He was one of very few scientists, and he became fascinated with using a small microscope to study the life around him. And in doing so, discovered bacteria, discovered protists, and sort of systematically over 50 or more years, just studied everything he could get his hands on. So, you know, his sperm, pepper water, what was in his pillow. And in doing so, he revealed this whole world right around him and his immediate surroundings. And with a kind of just childlike awe and adult obsession.
Now, a lot of this book is about microbial life, although we'll talk about other examples that are not microbial life. When you start to explore the microbial life in homes, I'm amazed how many species you discovered living in our homes. Was it 80,000 different species?
Yeah, it's at least 80,000, and that's just from the homes we've studied. And so you can imagine, I mean, we've studied a couple thousand homes at this point. So you can imagine if we're thinking about homes all around the world, that the number is much, much greater than that.
Now, I can definitely understand microbial life surviving in things like toilets or around, you know, where food's prepared. But some of the environments that you studied, and you talk about the experiments and how you gathered the data extensively in this book, they're extreme environments, and these have to be like extremophiles. Let's talk about showerheads, because we already brought that up. How did you get on showerheads?
So, I mean, a lot of science is having friends, and so I had a friend who got really interested in showerheads and what was living in them, and this is Noah Fear at the University of Colorado, and so he sent me an email and said, you know, do you want us to do a global study of showerheads, you in or not? Let me know today.
I'm amazed by your reaction. Was like, yeah,
I want. I mean, who wouldn't be in on that? I mean, that's the good stuff. So he had his reasons, and the reasons were that, you know, we know that, and this, what we know is sort of a starting point is so unusual that it needs a little bit of explanation. But we know that all tap water, all bottled water, has life in it,
right.
And that's just sort of, that's normal, and that's known. That wasn't like a big new discovery. And I think probably for most people that's at odds with their daily understanding of what they encounter. But it also was clear that in showerheads, you get this little stuff called biofilm, and I think it's a fancy scientist word for gunk. And it's a kind of apartment that multiple species of bacteria team up, and they make these little apartments to buffer them from the extreme conditions in the showerhead. And it was known that sometimes those little biofilms had sort of bad news species, and sometimes they had really good news species. But there was really very little understanding of when you got one and when you got the other. And so that's what NOAA wanted to study, and that's what we embarked upon.
And this gets to several species. Let's talk about mycobacterium. What are they?
Yeah, so the group of mycobacterium that we study is the non-tuberculous kind. And so there are mycobacterium that are really, really bad news, like tuberculosis, like leprosy. And this is sort of a very different lineage of from those microbes. But it's the same genus, same basic kind of life. And so a group of which we should be very aware, at least. And so the ones we find in showerheads, they're mostly not super problematic except under certain circumstances. And so if they become really abundant, if somebody's exposed to them and is immunocompromised, for a subset of older women, the details of that we don't really understand super well. But they're not... For the average person, they're typically not problematic. And yet, sometimes they become really abundant in showerheads. And in those cases, especially if people are immunocompromised, they seem to cause problems. And so that's the group we really wanted to understand. But what nobody really had a sense of, and we've got a partial look now, was where they're originally coming from. How are they getting in your showerhead?
Right.
What makes them common sometimes and rare others? How many of these species are there? And it seems ridiculous that we would not know, but we really didn't.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you gathered this information. You had people literally around the world taking samples from their showerheads?
Yes. So
but you ran into trouble in Germany.
We did. Well, in all of Europe, it was only the Germans who squawked about it. So in Europe, so we built the project around the idea that you would go to your shower, unscrew your showerhead, and then you would swab that gunk in there. But what we should have thought of and didn't is that many, perhaps most European showers are actually on that little hose, and so it's like that shower that you can get your back better with sort of thing, which meant that our whole sort of approach to sampling them didn't quite work. And so at first we weren't getting any samples from Europe, and we didn't know why, and then the Germans started chiming in that we had fundamentally misunderstood European bathing, which it was a lot of emails, and you still have to answer.
And they were sort of angry emails too.
They weren't very happy. Yeah.
but you gather all this
American.
You gather all this information, and what did you find?
So we found a lot of things, but one is that there was a much greater diversity of life in these showerheads than even we had anticipated. But the other was that in some regions we saw lots of mycobacteria, in other regions we saw much less. And part of what's going on appears to be that in water systems that are heavily chlorinated, there is more mycobacterium. I mean, in U.S. municipal water supplies, so like city water, there's more mycobacterium. And what we think is going on is that the mycobacterium are sort of wimpy. They're not very competitive microbes, and like in a normal sort of like in a pond or something, they get their butts kicked by everybody. But when we chlorinate the water really heavily, they're chlorine tolerant. And so all of their competition goes away, and they sort of like do their thing happily. And so in water with a lot of residual chlorine, you get more of these non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And we see signs of that in Europe as well, because most European water systems have very little residual chlorination, and some have none. And so there we actually saw much lower levels of non-tuberculous mycobacterium and different species.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, as you mentioned, in these houses that get their water from wells or aquifers, there could be things as large as amphipods, which are little crustaceans. And you would think that would probably freak you out if you saw that. But in fact, the greater diversity means that the water is actually healthier for us.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. So, I mean, it looks like if the ideal situation is that you are getting your water from some very old lovely aquifer underneath a big old forest, and the you have the right rock conditions and soil conditions, and so it's not toxic for other reasons. And the diversity of species in that aquifer are competing with the pathogens we don't want and doing you a good service in keeping your water healthy. The trick to that is if we break those old systems or if we move places that don't have enough aquifers to sustain us, then we have to rebuild the whole thing ourselves. And we really are not very good at remaking nature at this point in history.
Jesus, no. But this is one of the themes that keeps popping up and is one of the main themes of this book is our relationship to these microorganisms is critical to our health. There are examples of babies. There are examples of all sorts of things that go on through the book where a diversity is actually a good thing, and excluding obvious pathogens and stuff like that. But it's when we try to sterilize the environment that we seem to be running into trouble.
That's right. I mean, I think it seems counterintuitive that you know, a diversity of life on our bodies, in our homes, might be a better thing. But I think again and again, it's what we see. And there are caveats to that. Fungi seem to be a little different. But generally speaking, you know, we need a lot of kinds of species around us. And that's the opposite of the world we're creating. You know, we want to get rid of the 50 or so bacteria species we know are pathogens, and we don't want those around. But we want that rest of life. And I think one way to think about this is like when you go to the cleaning aisle in the store, which seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger until it merges with the pet food aisle and there's no food left. And you see all these products that say that they'll kill 99% of germs. And if you think about that for a minute, like that's the absolute worst percentage to kill. Because it's sort of like that showerhead scenario. What you're doing is you're getting rid of all of the sort of stuff that's easy to control, that easy to manage. And what you're leaving is that 1% that we're not good at getting rid of. And so that's the future we're building. We're building a future as a default where, you know, we've killed 99% of germs and left the 1%. Really bad news bears 1%.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Rob Dunn, professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. And we're talking about his book. It is a great read. Never Home Alone. From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. One of the things that even surprised me is the life in the International Space Station in Mir, because it always occurred to me they've probably worked really hard, and it's got to be, if there ever was a sterile environment, it's the space stations. But as you reveal in the book, nothing is going to be totally sterile ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times when I talk about this work, people say, well, you know, maybe you're finding a lot of life in other people's houses, but
not
some example, my house, because I can kill stuff. And I think the space station is interesting in that regard, and Mir even more so, because there you have a situation where like nothing's coming in through the windows. You have a lot of control over what's going up there. There's no stray dog walking in. And there's been an attempt iteratively to create relatively sterile conditions. And so what do you find? Well, Jenna Lang at UC Davis and colleagues used our same sampling approach we've used to work in houses on Earth to work with the astronauts to sample the International Space Station, and similar work had been done on Mir. And what Jenna found is that, in fact, the space station is covered with life. There's life all around the interior of the space station. But it's almost exclusively things that can grow on and eat the space station itself or things that are sort of falling from the astronauts. And so it sort of looks like a mix of like what you would see growing on sort of industrial waste and a toilet. Astronauts hate that when I say that. But so it's one model of a future that we can envision. It's a model where what survives around us is the sneakiest, most problematic stuff. And so that doesn't seem like a very good model. And indeed, the astronauts say it smells like feet.
As a matter of fact, it was the Mir smells like rotted apples or something. Mir has a different smell from ISS.
Yeah, the folks on the Mir tried less hard to create a sterile condition. Sterile conditions, and at one point they couldn't see through the windows on the Mir because there was the fungi were growing so well.
Oh whoa!
Yeah, and they were having valves that were cracking and breaking because fungi were finding ways. And Mir, but not the International Space Station, had yeast, which I suspect speaks to slightly more lax control over which alcohol made it up there.
Now, I have to talk about this because I just had an interesting conversation with my PT about this. I want to talk about a non-microbial life. I want to talk about camel crickets. Because this flipped me out when I read this. And I'm a natural historian. And camel crickets are a big cricket. And they look very unique. They have this sort of hunched back look to them. With these very long legs. And camel crickets are normally found in sort of forest detritus in sort of dark areas, and occasionally they come in the home. And one of the important things about this book for me is that nobody bothered to look at the camel crickets in the house because they just assumed that they were the same species that were around the house.
Yeah. The last great The last sort of big study of camel crickets was the 1960s and 70s, and since then there have been little bits and pieces, and there are many, many species. And you accurately depict their sort of normal natural history, and it was known that, in colonial America and afterwards, that they'd sort of moved into cellars and basements, and there were a bunch of species, some of them quite rare and potentially endangered. And we thought at one point in our project, well, let's just figure out what people, where these camel crickets are in houses. And it was a way, sometimes in our projects, like things take a long time and we need ways to engage people, so they don't get too mad that we haven't provided samples back and things. And so we just asked, do you have camel crickets in your house?
And you had them take photographs of them.
Well, initially we just asked, do you have them? And so when we did that, we get a map of where they were and weren't. And the map was wrong relative to everything we knew about where the camel crickets were. And then we had them take the pictures to figure out maybe they were looking at mice, who knew. And it turned out that almost all of the camel cricket individuals that people were seeing were of this giant Japanese camel cricket that had moved basement to basement across North America. And why that's surprising is that we didn't know. We didn't, it was known to be present in the U.S., but it was not known that it had taken over. And so that was mind-blowing.
It was absolutely mind-blowing. Is there any, how did, they just came in here in shipments like other kinds of invasives did?
It probably happened relatively early, and in our ability to discern when some of those early moves happen is not great. It was initially called a greenhouse cricket when it was first seen in the U.S., so maybe it came in on potted plants or something.
I got to tell you the story about my PT. So I'm getting worked on yesterday in my PT, so it's a delicate moment. She's working on my muscles, and I was talking about your book. And I mentioned camel crickets, and I first described them, and she totally freaked out. She had just seen one in her basement. And she had no idea what it was because she had never seen anything like that before, and she totally freaked out. And I said, well, don't kill it. Because one of the things you did is you followed up in research and trying to figure out what camel crickets eat. And that was fascinating.
Yeah, and partially because of your interaction with your PT, that we thought we'd made this discovery, everybody's going to be super excited, people are going to give us wreaths, and we'd walk down the maybe not quite like that, but we thought people would be excited. And
I was excited.
PT, yeah, well, thank you, Mark, I appreciate it. But yeah, the default reaction was the PT reaction, oh my God, that's a scary giant thing.
I'm going to kill it. That was her reaction.
Yeah, I'm going to kill it. It is large enough to be loved. I'll kill it. And so we started thinking, and people then asked, well, what good is it? And so we started thinking, what good could it be? And one of the things that eventually emerged out of conversations was, well, we know that these crickets eat really hard to break down food. What if they have some enzymes in their guts or microbes in their guts that could break down some waste products that we as humans want to get rid of, like plastics or, as turned out, the waste product of the paper and pulp industry, the stuff called black liquor. And so it's it looks as terrible as it sounds, right? It's like an alkaline bath, like And in the alkaline bath is lignin, so like the hard stuff from wood. And so right now that mostly gets burned, and it's what makes paper and pulp industries stinky. And so we thought, well, we'll try. Can we find in a camel cricket some microbes that can break this stuff down? And it shouldn't have worked. There's no, the odds were super against us, but I didn't totally know. And then in the first camel cricket we checked, we found a new species of bacteria that appears able to break down this stuff and turn it into energy.
Jesus, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was totally amazing.
It was totally, you're right, it's against all odds that you actually made it work.
No, and I mean, it helped that, I mean, it helped that we were a little bit ignorant of how bad the odds were.
I want to, before we run out of time, I want to make sure we talk about some of the important issues. One of the things, and we sort of talked a little bit about this at the beginning, is we need an ecology around us of microorganisms and other things to help prevent not just obvious diseases, but things like asthma and other kinds of weird allergies. And there's been some interesting studies that show there was one you mentioned that took place in Finland, in Karelia, where it was divided in half and you had sort of a natural study area. Talk about that.
Yeah, so Karelia is in the border of Russia and Finland now, and it used to all be part of Finland. And so you more or less you have the same populations of families that were then split after the war when part of Karelia became Russian. And so those families with similar genetic backgrounds had then very different socioeconomic, sociocultural fates. And one of the things that happened as a result of that, and I would say on the Russian side, much poorer, on the Finnish side, much more sort of Western, neo-industrial, urban, with sort of clean, modern houses, is that on the Russian side, allergies and asthma never became common, even as they were becoming common across the U.S. and much of Europe. On the Finnish side, on the other hand, same people, not only did allergies and asthma start to become common, but they're becoming common as fast as they are anywhere else in the world over the last sort of 30 to 50 years, depending on how you do the counting. And so the question then became, well, what's different on those two sides of the fence? And how do we think about that, what that means for the bigger story? And one of the things that people pretty early on identified was that on the Russian side of the border, people were much more exposed to daily biodiversity, to soil, to plants, both in their houses and outside of their houses. Versus on the Finnish side, people had become much more sealed off from nature. Their houses were more tightly sealed. They spent more hours indoors. Those indoor environments were more clean, in air quotes there. And so this idea emerged that what if what was going on here is that we need exposure to a specific set of species to make our immune systems make sense, to prevent allergy and asthma. And on the Finnish side, sealing themselves in, they have lost that exposure. And what's emerging is that, yes, this clearly is part of what's going on, that we used to be exposed to soil microbes, leaf microbes, air microbes, an extraordinary diversity of kinds of those microbes, and now we spend 23 out of 24 hours of the day inside in the U.S. and Finland and across Europe. And that's causing all sorts of dysfunctions of our immune systems that we're just starting to understand.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I can remember when I was a kid in school in the 50s, I don't remember anything about the number of allergies, like peanut allergies and stuff like that, occurring at all. And it almost seems like it just came about that all of a sudden a whole cadre of allergies just developed and spread.
No, I mean, it's amazing, it's a whole suite of problems that relate to the overreaction of our immune systems to our surroundings or to our bodies themselves. And so it's allergies, it's asthma, it's Crohn's disease, it's inflammatory bowel. And if, your listeners are average in an American medical sense, everybody knows somebody with these problems.
That's right,
And you didn't, even 15 years ago. And so it looks like a lot of this relates to these really dramatic changes we've made to which species we're exposed to. And the Western medical solution, often in something like a case like this, will be to say, well, let's figure out what one species we need and add that back. But I think the truth is, if we really look at what's going on, it's a whole suite of problems related to many, many kinds of changes. And so I suspect it'll be the case that we're too ignorant to make that kind of solution for a long time. And instead, we need to open our windows again and get back outside and stop trying to kill everything that lives.
And one of the things you found also is the greater diversity outside the house, the greater diversity inside the house.
That's right. And we saw that. The Finnish study you mentioned saw that. And so, you know, you can basically imagine the more kinds of species in your backyard, the more kinds of species in your right. house, the more kinds of species on your skin, on your children's skin. And on average, that tends to be beneficial. That tends to be the scenario you want.
This is an amazing book, and we could talk about it for years. My guest tonight has been Rob Dunn, professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. And we're talking about his book. I strongly recommend it. Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets, and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. Rob, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.